It's The Wonky Show. Student protests are making the headlines again this week, and we're asking if the balance of protecting free speech is being got right. Meanwhile, university leaders are in India drumming up business, so we're talking T&E, and the Conservative Party has announced a radical plan to shrink the higher education sector. Oh good. It's all coming up.
I was working with adults. I was paying my own way, and it gave an 18-year-old me a self-confidence that my university degrees never did. And unlike my degrees, I wasn't left with any debt. So we will shut down, rip off courses, and use the money to double the apprenticeship budget.
Welcome back to The Wonky Show, your weekly way into this week's higher education news, policy and analysis. I'm your host, Mark Leach, and joining me to review the week in HE policy, we have three fantastic guests. In London, it's Liz Hutchinson, Chief Executive at London Higher. Liz, your highlight for the week, please.
Well, since we've officially entered cosy season, Mark, I'm going to say my highlight of the week was curling up and watching a couple of episodes of Slow Horses, featuring, of course, the legendary Gary Oldman, a former student of Rose Bruford College, one of our members. And I just really love the brilliant shots of London, the greasy spoons, the back alleys and everything in between.
Highly recommended. And in Westminster, it's Jess Lister, Director for Education at Public First. Jess, your heart of the week, please.
Hello. I won a pub quiz for the first time ever, because it turns out having an extensive knowledge of higher education regulation doesn't usually help you in these things. And it didn't help me this week, but we did win. So that's my highlight.
And in Darlington is Jim Coe, Wonky's Associate Editor. Jim, your highlight of the week, please.
Mark, you already know my highlight. I'm in the country's seventh fastest growing economy. I'm 20 minutes from Durham, 30 minutes from Newcastle, 2 hours from London, 2 hours from Edinburgh. I am in the place with more civil service buildings than you can shake a stick at. I'm at home in Darlington.
Right, we start the week with student protests on campus. Jim, talk us through it, please.
Thanks, Mark. It's obviously been a challenging week for a number of reasons, but it is the anniversary of October 7th. And there's been concerns about student protests up and down the country. The Prime Minister, Keir Starmer, saying that the pro-Palestine student protests are not who we are as a country. You may have seen that this has caused interventions ranging from the likes of Universities UK and Bridget Phillipson, encouraging students not to break the law, either explicitly or inadvertently. I think the challenge that this has raised, of course, across the country, and you'll have seen some coverage about the student process that did take place, is the extent to which actions may be illegal, which generally there is no suggestion that they have been, and the extent to which they are seen as being inappropriate, not in good taste, offensive or hurtful to Jewish students. It raises a number of questions. The extent to which there should be regulatory interventions, the extent to which there's a political issue and whether government should be intervening, and the extent to which the right for students to convene on campus runs in the right for students to feel safe on campus, many who said they do not. It is a difficult issue and has received an exceptional amount of coverage over the course of this week.
Right, we have a clip from Bridget Phillipson, Education Secretary, about this.
There is much more that we need to do to tackle anti-Semitism in our society. I've heard directly from Jewish students about the impact that this has been having, and that's why it is essential that universities do more and act to protect students.
But today, I mean, students will be going to campus today and seeing these protests. Do you think they're safe today?
Well, university vice chancellors, university leadership will have to do everything within their power to make sure that that is the case. What can sometimes complicate matters is where protests will take place near universities but not on university grounds. That can make it more difficult for action to happen.
Right, there's a lot to unpack here. Liz, how do you think the sector's responding to this? Do you think it's getting the balance right in trying to balance everyone's different freedoms?
I think it's an incredibly difficult area and continues to be so, doesn't it? I mean, this term, we've got universities dealing with the new guidance, working through that in real time while they're coping with new students coming in, returning students and all the terrible things that have happened in and around the last few weeks and months. So I think it's incredibly difficult. I think what was quite notable about Keir Starmer's intervention, I thought, was that he was addressing his pleas directly to protesters, of course, many of them being students. And even that clip from Bridget Phillipson there, Mark, right at the end, there was a little sort of a small recognition that this is a difficult area for institutions, which I do think is welcome because it is challenging. And so my feeling is that universities are doing their best, but they're doing their best in very difficult circumstance. And let's see how this term pans out. I'm really pleased that OFS are going to be asking universities for kind of feedback of how that guidance is panning out. And in fact, they'll be coming to talk to London Higher members about that over the autumn.
Jess, I want to ask you about this because it's one of those cut-through moments, isn't it, where the sector's in the news, but not for the reasons it wants. But Keir Starmer talking about it, that's kind of broadly bad news, isn't it? when that starts happening. I mean, the sector's response has been quite fairly robust. What do how would you rate it so far?
Yeah, I think there are lots of reasons at the minute why you couldn't pay me to be a university vice chancellor. And this is one of them, because they are rightly, and we've had lots of sort of outward statements this week, including from Universities UK, saying, you know, anti-Semitism on campus is unacceptable and our Jewish students, you know, need to feel safe on campus and sort of safe in their identity, and at the same time juggling sort of requirements on freedom of speech and not closing down freedom of speech, and then sort of thirdly dealing with students who feel like this is something that they want to protest about and want to get involved in the protest, but maybe don't quite always understand all of the issues involved or understand, you know, why their actions might be making other students feel really uncomfortable. So, you know, at its best, I think we've seen the sector really try and, you know, create that place on campus for its Jewish students, but also try and, you know, educate people about this issue and why it's so important and why it's so serious. And, you know, not only this week is it the anniversary of the October 7th attack, we've also had the attacks up in Manchester. So, you know, the fever pitch of this is probably at its highest it's been for a little while. You know, the kind of final challenge is that there are lots of people, you know, in the media, in politics, that are waiting for universities and university leaders to get this wrong. It's a time when the sector is under a huge amount of scrutiny. And I think so far it's managed to walk that line between its kind of dual responsibility of freedom of speech and also kind of tackling anti-Semitism on campus.
Yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because it's sort of, it is in the news, but it isn't a kind of major flashpoint in that the sort of temperature seems fairly cool. And Jim, I was fascinated by Keir Starmer's comments. Actually, a lot of things he said were quite startling, some of the language. But it did, I mean, you know, obviously he's trying to kind of balance a lot of different things. One of them was the thing about lecturers who spout anti-Semitism being part of the problem. Now, obviously, that's something I think we can all agree with, that, you know, anti-Semitism is wrong and universities need to tackle it wherever it's found. But it did seem to me to be slightly playing into a bit of a trope. The thing that it called back to me was Sam Gyimah's left-wing madrasas comment always years ago. He is trying to kind of paint a picture, isn't he, of universities potentially being, you know, quite hostile environments, which is, it's a much more subtle, lighter version of the left-wing madrasas thing, and they're things we've had from conservative governments, but that it's kind of in there, isn't it?
I think the thing we have to be careful of in all of this is it's the generalizations of the specifics which can often get us into trouble, right? And I think if you look at the coverage in the build-up to October 7th, there was a lot of coverage saying universities are under pressure, students feel unsafe, and, you know, they should do something, plus the Keir Starmer speech. All the coverage afterwards is saying these protests took place, there were some unsavory things said, but actually there's no suggestion that universities had acted inappropriately in the majority of the media. I think the problem with statements like that, and I'm not, you know, in a position to say whether it's sort of true or not, is that it leads you into a position of taking absolute positions on these things, when in actual fact, universities have a mind-bendingly set of difficult regulations to put together. And only just to give a few, right? So they're still covered by all the equality obligations that they've always had, and their prime concern ensuring students feel safe on campus, particularly Jewish students. They've got all of the OFS regulations to ensure that students have the right to assemble and to protest and to undertake all of that. They have a set of political and media incentives, which is to ensure that they are seen to be doing the right thing as well as actually doing the right thing. And then, of course, they've got all of their usual HR, legal and other obligations to ensure that their staff and students are safe. This is a really, really difficult scenario to get through. And I'm not entirely sure that any politician standing up and saying this is true in the generality is helpful when this can only be managed on a very specific campus by campus basis.
I think what the other thing to remember is that, you know, this is all taking place in an incredibly sort of febrile environment. The anti-immigrant sort of rhetoric that's going on, the othering that's going on, there's been some horrible, vile comments this week about Birmingham. That's all adding to this sort of heightened, you know, anxiety, feeling of unsafe from students and staff and so on. And I think that's not helping. And I think that's just making it all the more difficult for universities to navigate this challenging space.
I mean, I think one of those things as well that just makes this, I suppose there's two things here, right? Universities have been dealing with this for a while now. And I would be interested if there is a view across the sector that actually the sector is becoming more skilled, is more compliant, is becoming more sort of astute at enabling the debate. But of course, the wider context of the global events which is taking place, this, I noticed there's debate over a peace deal even today, is always going to make this an extremely difficult environment. I think the thing that we can never really compare is how would any other similar institutions or set of institutions deal with mediating these debates? And it is unfortunate that they should be in universities, that they are always going to be at the very front of doing this.
And I think what we haven't seen yet, I mean, last year we obviously had a lot of the sort of Gaza encampments on university campuses, which I'm sure brought a whole host of kind of issues, not least sort of security issues for vice-chancellors to deal with. This year, a couple of people I spoke to said that they were generally very, very worried about, you know, students supporting Palestine Action, you know, them being a proscribed organisation, and the consequences of that for the student being incredibly significant. And the universities, a lot of universities were kind of planning for what they would do in that circumstance. And again, I come back to the universities, I think, that are tackling this best and not just trying to, you know, create the welcoming space on campus, but really trying to educate people about, you know, the issue, the rights to free speech, the rights to protest, and kind of, you know, what anti-Semitism is and isn't. And I think it's that education piece for me that is really important, because this issue, you know, may dial itself down a little bit in the coming weeks and months, but isn't going to go away.
I mean, look, even doing this podcast, it is clearly very difficult to talk about these issues. And we are people who think about this and it's impacting universities all the time. There is also just a matter of taste in all of this, which I think we find difficult. And I think the comments saying that actually it is clearly inappropriate to host a protest on what is the day of mass grieving will have lots of sympathy, because of course it feels difficult. And at the same time, you have groups of students who are saying there is never a bad day in which to highlight injustices. That was a sort of specific quote. I think universities are going to end up getting criticized either side of doing that work. I think finding a safe space through which students feel able to continue their studies within the regulatory framework is about the best they are going to get. The media coverage and the sort of political blowback of that is going to be beyond their control in lots of ways.
The other thing that someone was sort of saying to me yesterday was that, you know, actually the way in which students, young people express their views is also generational and also changes over time. So, you know, some of the younger protesters slash students that are involved at the minute are students that spent some quite significant parts of their teens in lockdown, for instance. And is there something there about, you know, the coming together with others and, you know, the way in which they express their views being different perhaps to previous generations, or, you know, and might be different still, you know, in the years to come. So I think that that's another indication of this kind of shifting environment and something that we're constantly going to have to come back to.
It does strike me, Liz, to your earlier point where, you know, if the Office for Students are doing lots of work about what's the learnings from these things, how do you support it, doing a retrospective on how the universities have dealt with difficult issues like this and how it may into the future would seem like an extremely valuable use of their time to me.
Jess, do you think students are listening when vice-chancellors and prime ministers tell them, you know, where and what to protest?
No, I don't think so. I think if you spend as much time as I do on, too much time, Instagram and social media, that's where they pick up what to do and what to think. You know, not entirely, you know, people make their own views about this, but a lot of this comes from sort of information sources that, you know, the government or vice chancellors don't have any control of. You know, when I used to work for university, we sat in countless meetings where the topic of the meeting was how to get students to read emails. So I'm not sure that you know, I think this is a legacy problem that no one's ever managed to tackle. And I don't think that many students read The Times, which is where Keir Starmer kind of made his op-ed today. But I think what people are trying to do is, you know, you have to say something on this, right? You have to show leadership on this issue. And both from the government side and from universities, that's what we've seen this week. And we've also got to remember in this, you know, that students are sort of adults with agency, and what universities are really trying to deal with here is kind of guiding people, sometimes young people, but sometimes not, sort of through their views on what's a really, really tricky issue.
Right, let's see who's been blogging for us this week.
Hi, my name is Dr. Leanne Timpson, and I'm a lecturer in microbiology at Nottingham Trent University. This week on Wonky, I've been writing about questioning technique in education and how a student response of "I don't know" can be turned into the beginning of a knowledge-gaining experience. My thoughts on this subject are a result of my own experience as a postgraduate student during my MSc and PhD, as well as in more recent years as a lecturing academic, where I use my experience and intuition to decide on when, where, and what type of question to pose given the situation, and how to respond if the answer is "I don't know." This is all undertaken with the aim of supporting students and providing them with a framework that they can use to build their own knowledge and to start the process of inquiry.
Now, a big chunk of the sector's in India drumming up business. Jess, walk us through it.
Yes, so Parliament is still in recess and the Prime Minister has taken 125 CEOs and small business leaders and university vice-chancellors on holiday to India to kind of celebrate and progress the UK-India trade deal. There is an amazing line in the press release for this, which says that 70 million places are needed in India by 2030, which creates a huge opportunity for UK universities seeking new funding streams. And we've seen this year a lot of universities announcing new branch campuses and new types of transnational education provision. But that sound you can hear in the corner is the official in the Home Office screaming, because no one is yet sure about whether we are entering a future where more and more universities set up overseas or more Indian students travel to the UK for our world-leading education offering. It's a really interesting one to watch because we are seeing the kind of immigration versus export debate playing out in live time.
I mean, this is good for universities, isn't it? And obviously they're embracing it, but there is, as Jess pointed out, kind of a real contradiction at the heart of government policy when it comes to universities abroad, international students, who goes where, when, how, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I think some of those statistics that have just come out from UUKI, I think really interesting. And for me, you know, to see that we're now roughly at half and half with, you know, students over here studying in country and those studying elsewhere. And I do think it's a question for the sector about where we want that balance to land. I think from a London perspective, I definitely don't want to see our international student population decline even further, either steadily or rapidly. I think that would be a really bad thing economically, not just for institutions, but for the country, culturally, socially, and also soft power. And I think the fact that the Foreign Office were involved in the international education strategy really says everything about that importance of soft power. So yeah, I think it's an interesting one, and something that really needs to be, that sort of conundrum really does need to be worked through.
It's a good news story though, right, Mark? Like in an era where the UK feels like it has lost a bit of its global sort of economic clout and doesn't really know what it's here for or what we're doing or what the purpose of all of this is, having a major industry with genuine global appeal that is showing demonstrably strong growth surely seems like the type of thing the government would get behind. Like, surely this is good that this is happening.
I do agree with that, but I think at the same time, it's a little bit of a warning call, isn't it? Because it's kind of reminding us at a very important moment that international students do have options, and not all of them do want to come and study in the UK, and not all of them are actually able to, you know, make the financial and or personal sacrifices to do so. They do have other options and they will take them. And so I think in some ways it's a little bit of a sort of a warning that, you know, if we're going to keep making it harder for international students to come here, they simply won't. And that's, as I said, bad news, I think, for all of us.
Yeah, I agree, Liz. And I suppose the other challenge is that the structure of TNE is just simply different, right? So inevitably, if the government chooses a set of incentives which makes it harder to recruit international students, universities are going to find other ways to support international education. But there is a sense in the sector that trying to deliver surpluses through TNE is exceptionally difficult. So if the expansion has been driven because it is part of a big strategy to increase global reach and improve education and sort of develop new partnerships, I think that's brilliant. If the banking here is that it can make up for lost income through other sources, I don't think that is going to pan out as people may imagine.
And I really do worry that the sort of rush into TNE, you know, number one, there's no evidence that I've seen that it you know, does create this lucrative new investment stream very quickly. You know, it's a kind of long-term bet that a lot of these universities are making. And number two, it feels to me at the minute like a complete Wild West. And whenever that happens, you know, usually at some point bad practice follows. So, you know, when you see expansion happening, you know, at this scale and at this speed, I do worry a little bit about whether the sector is leaving itself vulnerable, you know, to, again, accusations of lower quality or lower quality assurance, or, you know, these are really kind of sensitive things. And, you know, at the minute, the Indian government is very, very open to, you know, UK higher education and UK higher education institutions setting up these campuses. You know, there's the 14 vice chancellors going on this trip, not just one and not just UK, is a real kind of sign of strength of that. But they could also change their minds if what they see in 2 to 3 to 4 years' time is, you know, poor practice and poor quality education. And that's the point it gets really difficult for the sector. And I think it's got to be quite careful about, you know, the kind of rush to T&E, you know, has to be backed up with a real kind of caution on quality, just as it would in the UK market as well.
And it should also fit into a wider strategy, right? So like T&E isn't a single thing. There's lots of models of delivering T&E. So, you know, you've got like traditional branch campuses, you've got distance learning, partnerships, you know, I suppose the term flying faculty, that's much less popular than it used to be. But my feeling is, and I say this to someone who's never ran T&E but done research into it, is that having a model which fits with the strategy of the organization and its existing expertise makes it a significantly more manageable enterprise than simply going, this economy looks quite strong, these students look comparable to students we've recruited through other means, how do we align these two things? Particularly when there is resource constraints on the sector, trying to, as you say, Jess, ensure the quality with less cash in different environments strikes me as being trebly hard to do.
Mm. And I was going to say a similar thing, actually, that not all institutions are going to be good at this, are they? Some of them are going to be very good at it, some of them aren't. And I think Michael makes that point in his blog on the Wonky website that, you know, perhaps what will happen is that there'll be some universities that do this and do it really well and some that just, you know, don't. And I just wonder if it's kind of, how do we work out, how do we help institutions to make that decision about whether it's right for them and whether they can do it successfully? And the good news is that there is some really good, strong and long-held experience in the UK of doing T&E. I mean, in London alone, you've got University of London been doing it for years. Middlesex University have had two very successful campuses in Dubai and Mauritius for over 20 years now. So I think, you know, it's sort of getting the sector to learn together and to share best practice, you know, like the GIST report showing about how to do this well and how to make sure it's serving its purpose.
And the final thing I'll say that makes me nervous on this is you have seen quite a lot this year universities making these dual announcements about the number of staff they are cutting at home and the overseas campus they are setting up abroad. And I think, you know, you can understand from a business perspective why those decisions are being made. But again, to bring this back to the kind of UK political perspective, the government strategy and all of this is a mess. You can see it in the kind of DBT press release celebrating this. But at the same time, we've got the international student levy being brought in and we've got kind of a much harsher rhetoric in other departments. So there is no guiding principle for this thing that is coming from government. And what I think universities just need to be a little bit cautious about how this rush for overseas expansion sort of plays with the things that matter back home, which is usually, you know, are there enough places for domestic students? And in particular, are there enough places for middle class parents to send their kids to high tariff universities still?
I mean, it's really hard to make the cutthroat argument that recruiting international students is the only means to open up home spaces. I think you're right, Jess. It's probably even harder to say educating international students but not in the UK is the thing that opens up spaces for home students. Like, of course it's true if you spend all your days thinking about higher education like we do, but it's not intuitively obvious.
That messy policy thing as well that Jess just mentioned, I think it must be very strange for the vice-chancellors that have accompanied Keir Starmer to go to a country where it's very clear that they believe higher education is the answer and they're so encouraging and wanting their domestic students to take up higher education, and not just in science, but they're, you know, very keen in humanities and social sciences as well. And then, to get back off the plane at Heathrow or wherever they've landed to see that we're still in this mess here and that there's still so many policy questions to work through.
Hello, it's Debbie from Team Wonky here, reminding you that the Festival of Higher Education is coming up soon on the 11th and 12th of November at the University of London Senate House. We'll be in conversation with some big names like Minister for Skills Jackie Smith, Office for Students Chair Edward Peck, and author and journalist Ian Dunt. And over two jam-packed days, we'll be tackling policy agendas, debates, and all the big issues facing higher education with expert speakers and loads of opportunity for debate and discussion. But more than that, it's a chance to get your head out of the day-to-day, meet some fantastic people from across the sector, really talk and think about what's going on and what we can collectively do about it. You'll return to your desk energised with a roster of exciting new contacts and fresh ideas. So, what's not to like? We will see you there. To find out more, view the full programme and buy your ticket, go to thefestivalofhe.com or follow the links from Wonky's homepage.
So the Conservatives have been meeting in Manchester and have been announcing higher education policy. Liz, tell us about it.
Yes, so you might have seen a photograph of Kemi Badenoch sitting at her desk in a very gloomy, dark hotel room, finishing off her speech for party conference. Presumably what she was doing there was putting the finishing touches to this announcement, which they say is going to radically reform higher education if they're returned to office. What it amounts to is them cutting 100,000 student places through student number controls, and that would be based on both quality and graduate outcomes. They reckon it's going to save £3 billion, which would double the apprenticeship budget, and then rather hopefully, I think, then say that anything left over from that would go into support high-cost courses. And they say they're doing this to tackle what they're calling debt-trap degrees, students not getting a positive return from their studies, and also leaving the treasurer or the taxpayer, as they put it, with £7 billion in unpaid loans to write off at the end of each year. So a few retro vibes here with the discussion of student number controls, about what subjects are or are not valuable, and of course the current sort of heightened interest in apprenticeships as well.
Right. We have a clip, I think, of Kemi Badenoch announcing this.
Let's talk about university. Every year, thousands of young people go off to university but leave with crippling debt and no real prospects. Nearly one in three graduates see no economic return. And every year, taxpayers write off over £7 billion in unpaid student loans. Wasted money, wasted talent. That's every year. A rigged system propping up low-quality courses while people can't get high-quality apprenticeships that lead to real jobs. And this is personal for me. I did two degrees, one in engineering, one in law, but I also had an apprenticeship first. And while I can't remember how to do parallel integration, I can remember how to fix a broken computer, which I learned to do during my apprenticeship. I was working with adults, I was paying my own way, and it gave an 18-year-old me a self-confidence that my university degrees never did. And unlike my degrees, I wasn't left with any debt. So we will shut down rip-off courses and use the money to double the apprenticeship budget.
So, Jess, didn't have this on the bingo card, actually, a Conservative Party policy on HE this week. But yes, what I mean, should we be taking this literally?
Yeah, it's been quite a lively conference season for higher education, having had a few years of not really having much to say. So number one, the thing that matters more here is the rhetoric rather than the actual policy. So anyone that would like to make themselves feel very clever by pointing out that this is actually a nonsense policy, which would be totally unworkable, that's kind of not the point here, right? Like they're just stating the intention, which is...
So we can stand down the tableaus. We don't need to...
Stand down the tableaus. You know, they are stating the intention, which is fewer students in universities and more apprenticeships. If you've heard that one before, it's because that's also what Keir Starmer said a week previously. The thing that I thought was kind of particularly interesting here, and I'm going to have a new sign made, is that you can't just make apprenticeships happen. You can just make university places happen, right? You can fund universities, you can fund FE colleges, and they can, you know, expand and start new courses. An apprenticeship is an employer, you know, creating a vacancy and a training place, and it is not as easy to, you know, just create an apprenticeship out of thin air. It is especially not very easy to create 100,000 apprenticeships, you know, presumably at least level 5, if not level 6, and that is even saying that we don't do level 7 apprenticeships anymore. You can't just make that happen. And that seems to be where all of the policy goes at the minute. And plenty of people have tried, right? Like the apprenticeship levy tried to do this. But what we haven't had announced here is any kind of, you know, the Conservative Party didn't come out with a very detailed, you know, plan to rework the apprenticeship levy or anything like that. So the rhetoric to me is more interesting than the actual policy. And the most interesting thing is that both parties are in different ways sort of saying a similar thing.
Mm. I think, and on that point, I think that as well as not being able to just make apprenticeships happen, you also can't just make people want to do apprenticeships. And I think there's a massive piece of work to do in terms of raising esteem of sort of further education and apprenticeships. And a lot of Conservative voters do want their young people in their lives, whether that's their grandchildren or children, to go to university. So, you know, it sort of overlooks that massive piece that needs to be done around esteem and, you know, the attractiveness of not going to higher education and doing something else.
It's a really strange one, I think, because obviously I think everybody thinks that there's no chance the Conservatives are going to win the next election with the current leader. You know, like sort of next to none kind of territory. So what I don't understand is if you could have all the higher education policy proposals you want to propose in the world as the leader of the opposition, why effectively what you would say is let's cut a little bit of numbers, put some money into apprenticeships, and let's have some student number caps on universities and very good money. It's the kind of sort of political rhetoric that was floating about in not the last iteration of Conservatives. Conservative government, but the leaders before that. In some ways, it's not a very ambitious reform program, right? It's just a bit on cost efficiencies and sort of move some stuff about. I wonder if in a period where the Conservative need any headlines they can possibly get, they might have done something a bit more. And particularly when Labour is proposing things like an international student levy, this looks sort of small beer by comparison.
One of the things that I think was interesting for me was this: the sorts of things, yet again, that are considered low value. And I saw mentioned somewhere three things: languages, creative arts and sports sciences. And, you know, if we just take those in turn, well, it would by all means cap the number of students studying languages, because there's simply not enough people studying languages at the moment. And that's been something that's been a concern for a long time, cross-party actually, about the decline in language learning. And we're really hoping that that will be something that will feature in the curriculum review. Creative arts, well, one of the UK's most successful kind of industries, certainly in London, something that we're synonymous with. And in the capital city alone, one in five jobs are in the creative economy. And then sports sciences, I mean, again, like creative sports, you know, UK sports is probably one of our biggest brand exports, as well as a massive economic driver. So quite why those three have been singled out, I'm not sure. But I guess it just comes back to this sense of, on what measures are we saying that things are, you know, not necessary, not valuable, and not things that we want people to be studying.
As an English graduate, Liz, I'm particularly resentful of the English being bumped in to the sort of rip-off degrees, you know, mantra. I mean, you know, there's some imagination, I suppose, in picking a different set of things to point out their rip-off degrees. The much bigger problem is, and I suppose Jess alludes to, is that the labour force is so dynamic and the economy is changing so much. Is to try and pick some degrees and be like, actually, these things aren't useful anymore, is to pretend that we can assume what the economy is going to look like in a few years from now. And, you know, if you want more work-based learning, fine. You have to force employers to do that in some way. But taking students out of higher education numbers will make the system a bit cheaper, but basically do nothing else for any of the other ambitions. And I suppose where this falls down is that I think Labour sees universities as an instrument for economic growth, not necessarily a sort of site of it in and of its own self. The Conservatives don't really have a clear economic message. So when they pick the higher education stuff, it just seems a bit random and to come out of nowhere, really.
And I think what we've got at the end of party conference season is two quite uninspiring visions for higher education. You know, nobody left Labour Party conference feeling in the sector feeling kind of super pleased with Labour's vision, which includes seemingly, you know, fewer international students, or, you know, the same number of international students by some miracle, a kind of subject-only focused maintenance grant, and a push towards sort of tertiary rather than HEE. The Conservatives have said quite similar things. You know, we want to restrict certain subjects. We think some subjects are good and some subjects are bad. We want fewer people going to university and more people doing apprenticeships. If the sector doesn't like either of those two visions, I think what it needs to start working on is re-articulating its own case. So, like, what is the sector's vision for itself? Like, I'm struck by what you just said, Liz, about, you know, the benefits of these sort of creative arts subjects, of English subjects. You know, everyone I meet has an English or a history degree. Half of Cabinet has an English or a history degree. So if we want to start making those arguments again, it has to be not picking apart the political visions that we have and saying why they're wrong or why they are kind of, you know, missing the point or missing the growth. It's almost starting again with a blank sheet of paper and saying, right, this is what we need, and getting that kind of cross-party consensus, because there's currently more that unites the Conservatives and Labour on higher education policy than any other issue. They talk about it in different ways, but it's the kind of same core. And I think the sector's response to that needs to be a little bit more visionary and a little bit less kind of, you know, defensive.
I would question about how close they are. I mean, if Kemi Badenoch basically says that, you know, writing off £7 billion of student loans is essentially waste, that means, you know, the implication of that is that, you know, the state would not underwrite higher education, would put, you know, basically nothing into it. If, you know, if she doesn't want that £7 billion, then, you know, that's the whole kind of kit and caboodle, isn't it? So, you know, she's also signaling to me, you know, withdrawal. I mean, it's not, as you say, Jess, we shouldn't be taking every single word literally and trying to model it. But I mean, that's a much more radical statement than anything Labour have said about what they, you know, how they see the role of the state in funding higher education.
Though I do wonder if it's accidentally radical. I'm not entirely sure, as you say, that they've quite understood what they've announced and whether they just wanted, you know, £3 billion to find to put into something else. But you are right. Again, there are differences, and definitely the Conservatives have gone much, much further, and their proposals would be much, much more damaging to the sector. But there is this common core that is kind of becoming the cross-party consensus on higher education, and I'm not sure I like it. I'm not sure many people in the sector like it, and I don't really see at the minute an alternative.
I think on the vision point, you know, we're not seeing a vision from any party at the minute for higher education. And I agree with Jess that, so that's for us, right, as a sector to set out our vision for what higher education is and how it can contribute. And, you know, in London, how that works for both the region, the nation and the world in things like creative arts, health, all the things that we're well known for and do well in. So I think that vision piece is for us really now, because we're not getting it from the political parties.
Yeah, the only thing I was going to add is that they are different visions, but they have the same versions of less but better. And the Labour less but better is fewer higher paying international students to fund programmes, I think is important. And the Conservative less but better is some version of massively reduce how much higher education costs and get a quite random set of things they think is valuable. So I agree with you on that front, Jez. I'm not sure in reality when they both hit the actual, you know, sort of political mechanisms, they will end up being as radical as either of them set out.
So that's about it for this week. Remember to go in deep on anything we discussed today. You'll find links in the show notes on wonky.com. Don't forget to subscribe. Just search for The Wonky Show wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like what you heard today, do come to the Festival of Higher Education in November, where we're picking up many of the themes in the big debate. Details on wonky.com. So thanks so much to Liz, Jim, Jess and Michael Salmon, who makes the show happen behind the scenes. We'll be back next week. Jim D will be here. Until then, stay wonky.